here, I see.
Well, thank you, Michael. Let's give Michael a hand for the presentation. So we're going to take some time for questions, and so be thinking about questions. I see a few hands going up already. But while you're thinking about your questions, I want to remind you that we will give you an opportunity to contribute to this ministry through the free will offering. So if fellows could come up, we'll do that. And just a comment that Michael made about global warming. Obviously, he's written a number of papers on global warming. And when Larry Vardaman was here in May, he also mentioned global warming. He's written a lot of papers on that, and actually I've published some on that as well. Go ahead. And you might wonder, you know, where do we all stand on that? I think we all stand on the same place as far as global warming is concerned. You heard Michael mention the fact that carbon dioxide is like 0.04% of our atmosphere. And that's going to control our climate? I don't think so. And carbon dioxide is not a poisonous gas either, like some people would say. And I'd often wondered, since you know, we have the same view of evolution versus creation as on the global warming issues, why is it that we're on the same side? And I've come to the conclusion it's because man thinks that they can control where man's going as far as, you know, evolving, if you will, and no checks, just cash. I'm sorry. We can only accept cash at this point. But the point is, we think the same way because man thinks that he can control where he's going, and he thinks he can even control the climate. And so that's why the three of us agree on that, but the secular world obviously does not. So with that, let's go to some questions.
Well, before I start, I forgot to talk about some free resources. I have some sign-up sheets for the Creation Research Society newsletter back there, and InfoBytes, which is an online newsletter. So they're back there at the table. So anyway, questions?
Yeah, question. You back there when you said that the original temperature of the Earth's ocean after the flood was 86 degrees, 30 degrees centigrade.
Yeah.
And where did you come up with that number? You just said you assumed it.
Yeah, I did.
Come out right?
How did I get that? Okay. I went over that pretty quick. I assumed it because there's lots of ways to heat the water up. In fact, all models of the flood, as far as I know, have a heat problem, that they're going to cause too much heating. So, but there comes a point where if you have too much heat in the oceans, too hot, you're going to kill a lot of the fish and marine mammals that we see here. I mean, it'd be too hot for them. And this is an average, by the way. There were cool spots and warm spots, 30 degrees centigrade. Is an average. So I figured you can't stretch it much above 30 degrees as the average before you organisms that we see today die off. So I stretched it as far up as I could, and like I said, all mechanisms of the flood have too much heat, and so there's no problem getting the heat. It's too much. So that's how I got that. It's a very indirect way, but I couldn't do any better.
Let me preface my statement by saying I am a Christian, and there's nothing in the Bible that I disagree with. However, you've said, you know, I believe in what happened during Noah's flood. What was the number of days you said that the boat was afloat?
Oh, it was actually afloat about anywhere from 110 to 150 days. It landed but the flood was 371 days long.
Right. Okay, I can accept that. But you also say that this ice age kind of started immediately.
Oh, I believe it did.
Okay, you had all these aerosols and the volcanic action. Mm-hmm. How did Noah, his wife Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and their wives How were they able to survive this ice age that came on them immediately?
Well, they got off the mountain quick, I think. But they were, if they were in the mountains of Ararat, we're not, there's some controversy over what that means exactly, but if they're at high altitude at the end of the flood, it's going to start cooling rapidly, so they headed down, and they probably lived in the Middle East in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, which would be have milder summers and cooler winters, which would be a great climate for the ice age in those areas. Oh no, only 30% of the land was covered by snow and ice, and that's at mid and high latitudes.
Any other questions coming up here?
There you go. That's where it is in North America.
And actually, this is sort of a follow-up on the question we just had.
Mm-hmm.
You've got this big ice age going on, 30% of the land mass. We've got water that's superheated, and you're afraid it's going to cook the fish.
You're right.
When we look at Grand Canyon, for example, and there are hundreds of feet of sedimentation covering the surface of the landmass.
Mm-hmm.
And we can look at the ark and see that the land animals, Noah and his family, survived that. We've got all these aerosols in the air that are darkening the planet. How on earth in all of this catastrophe could plants have survived anywhere on the face of the earth to have fed the animals that we're going to support, you know, that,
oh, because
that would be
you did get enough sunlight through. Yeah, I mean, you didn't, it didn't all get reflected out.
Okay, but
came through.
But when you look at, like, the Grand Canyon and other places, there was so much sedimentation, all the seeds, all of the rhizomes, all of the tubers, all of the things that would propagate plants must have been buried under hundreds of feet of sedimentation. And what wasn't buried under hundreds of feet was cooked in this hot ocean, or was getting shaded out by the aerosols, or getting frozen out by these glaciers. It seems like with all of this super catastrophe ideas, I'm not seeing any mechanism for which plant life could have survived. There was no ark for the plants.
Well, let's think about this. In fact, I got a whole ebook on the topic. From the amount of coal that we have in the earth, we can determine that there's probably about 9 to 10 times as many plants and vegetation on the surface of the earth than we have now. So this got all ripped up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of it did get buried. And a lot of it, trees are out there as petrified trees. But we had a lot of it would float. It'd have monstrous log mass like that Spirit Lake, Mount St. Helens, floating on the surface of the earth for the flood. Even well after the flood, they would be floating because they don't sink very fast like you can observe at Spirit Lake today. So yeah. You can have seeds, you can have in there, and as the waters are draining, they would let down on the surface and reseed it pretty quick. And then, you know, so there's plenty of vegetation that would float. You'd have seeds floating, but you'd have a lot buried too. Oh. I answer your question.
Well, you gave me an answer, but no, it really doesn't answer the question.
You asked how do we get the plants after the flood,
most,
right?
I've been a farmer and a nurseryman all my life, and I can tell you there are very few land-based plants that can survive being in water for more than maybe a week or more.
Some people have done experiments and shown that some plants can... Well, that's quite a while.
Tomato seeds and some other things can, but you know, most of trees, for example, are going to drown out very quickly and not be able to reproduce. Most, you know, pine cones and such, their seeds are going to drown out very quickly. There's just so much vegetation that, you know, when you take into consideration the kinds, mm-hmm. just like we have animal kinds, plant kinds, such a huge percentage of the terrestrial plant kinds cannot survive being submerged in the water. They cannot survive being buried under hundreds of feet of sedimentation. They cannot survive being superheated. They cannot survive a thick cloud of aerosols. They cannot survive under a mile of ice. And there is no arc to keep the variety of plant kinds in existence like we had for the animals and man.
Well, you've asked a lot of questions. You know, but some of these are research areas.
Well, I realize it, and I guess that's my dilemma, is that I hear a lot of research answers about man and the ark, which is very credible, and I hear a lot of research about, the animals, and hear things about how the Ice Age could have come, and all of these answers are very credible, but I don't ever hear anybody talk about how plants could have survived the sin flood and the following natural events, and there's no way that man and animals, man and terrestrial animals could survive if there isn't a plant base going on to sustain them.
Well, of course. I bet you if you look on creation.com and Google one of those 8,000 articles, you'll probably find several articles on that. I know other creationists have dealt with this. This is a common question. In fact, it might be in the answers book, but I don't know.
Yeah, I would suggest looking at the answers book, and possibly also even ICR may have done some research on that.
Yeah, I mean, off the top of my head, I think the log mats were so thick, you had a lot of vegetation that was above water during the flood, and that was not actually in the water. I mean, say, for instance, you just had the biosphere we have today, and suddenly you floated in the ocean, and they collect in huge mass like that big pile of garbage out in the middle of the Pacific. you might have 100 feet of debris, and a lot of it's going to be above the water. So there are ways to explain these things. Of course, we don't expect plants and seeds that were buried by hundreds of feet of sediment to sprout out. They're buried, and they're found as fossils. Those are the fossils today. So there are ways to explain that, and others have explained it. And that's what I can add by the log mat that were floating on the surface of the earth during the flood and even after the flood. It can explain a lot of things, and that's what this book is about, explaining riddles of the flood by the log mats. Okay.
Okay, I have two questions. First of all, I have my grandparents have property at Blue Lake, Washington, which is right there by Dry Falls.
Right.
We know about the rhinoceros. We get to see that grandparents.
Blue Lake Rhino, right.
Yeah, they homesteaded all that. And so we vacation right where you did your book on the Missoula flood, and we look at that all the time.
Oh, good. Thank you.
So my question is, my occupation is a pilot. And I sit there and I look at the evidence of the flood that went over the Dry Falls, went over all the lakes, all the way down to Ephrata, and you can see it. But as I fly over, I'm trying to imagine where that water came from. But I know the theory is it came out of Missoula on the Missoula.
Glacial Lake Missoula.
Right. I'm having a hard time connecting the dots because when I fly over the country and I see from Spokane, Coeur d'Alene, and the mountain ranges there, I don't see the evidence of the scarring that I would see that did such devastation over the Dry Falls and that area, and yet I don't see the scarring from the air. I don't see a massive water supply. So my first question then is there another source of water maybe closer into Canada above Banks Lake and into that area that might have supplied the water? And the second question, let's ask them both here. Again, it comes back to the water temperature, sorry. When I first heard that theory, I thought it was I had a hard time understanding it because having been to Hawaii or some other place in the South Pacific, it's nice, warm, wonderful place to be. So how far inland does this warm air mass have to go before it actually cools? I see on your map there, obviously it had to go quite a ways. And might that explain the area around Alaska? You said it's a great mystery. If we had these warm waters becoming your Hawaii tropic temperatures and actually had to hit the mountain range before it cooled off. So the second question more specifically is, how far do we have to get Hawaii-like temperatures into an ice age sheet.
Okay, your first question was there another lake further north of Banks Lake? Is that what or Blue Lake? Right. Yes, there was. there was Glacial Lake Columbia. It was backed up by the Okanagan Lobe that came down through Omak and up on what's called the Waterville Plateau, and it blocked the Columbia River there near Grand Coulee Dam and formed a lake there. So when Glacial Lake Missoula broke, it came through a Coeur d'Alene Spokane area, generally just dumped gravel. That's why it's a huge aquifer there. It's hundreds of feet of gravel in there. And then it lifted up Glacial Lake Columbia, and it spilled over to the southwest, forming Grand Coulee, Moses Coulee, and the Cheney Palouse scab lands going southwest. So, you know, every place is different because it was a different hydrology. So you don't see the features you see at Dry Falls, you don't see those around Spokane. You have a different signature there. And as far as the warm water, yes, the warm water would slow the ice age in a lot of places with onshore flow like this area here. I don't believe that this area was glaciated right away. It was a dynamic feature where the best areas to glaciate with all that warm water and the cool continents would be over central and eastern Canada. That would start glaciation right away. And the mountainous areas would glaciate at high altitudes. And because of onshore flow, it would delay. And that is exact, whoops. I was gonna show you just like you said with pointed out with Alaska, the lowlands, that's why they weren't glaciated, I believe, because of that warm onshore flow. So I hope I answered your two questions.
Okay, any more questions? There's one here.
Do you believe in the water canopy theory?
That
would answer some questions about misplaced water.
The water canopy is a deduction from scripture, the waters above. Mm-hmm. Dr. Larry Vardaman, who was here in May, I guess. He's here now. Oh, hi there, Larry. I didn't see him. he's done a lot of modeling and has discovered that if there was too much water in the vapor canopy, it would heat up too much. It'd be too hot, and it would heat up the surface. Also, as that water condenses from vapor to liquid, it gives off what's called latent heat, which is a huge amount of heat, and it would cook Noah and the crew. So because of these radiation problems and possibly a super greenhouse, either the water vapor, the canopy was thin, maybe with 4 feet of precipitable water. That means that much water spread out in vapor form. That's what they call precipitable water in meteorology. So it's either about 4 feet or less, or we didn't have any. It's a very controversial area. I used to believe at 80%, you know, using meteorological jargon, probability. And now I go along with the 20%. I still think it is worth investigating and doing research on, but remember, it's not an absolute from the Bible. It's a deduction, a reasonable deduction, and very reasonable, actually, but it has problems, and that's the status of it. And if you want to know a lot more about it, the guy, Larry back there, can tell you a lot more about it.
Really quick. How long do you think it took for the ice to set in enough that people wouldn't, or animals wouldn't be able to migrate? And also, do you think that the animals and people migrated before or after the ice age?
Oh, I think they migrated, especially during the ice age. One thing about the ice age I didn't tell you is that you not only have cool summers, you'd have mild winters. So the winters in Siberia would be a lot milder because the onshore flow and all the latent heat adding heat to the atmospheric storms. So it wouldn't be such cold temperatures for animals to migrate from the mountains of Ararat through northeast Siberia, cross into Alaska, it's very shallow in the Bering Strait, down through an ice-free corridor along the east slopes of the Rockies, It was delayed along the east slopes of the Rockies, so they can go clear to the United States, Central and South America. So the animals can spread, because of the Ice Age, could spread to the Americas. And so, and anyway, I kind of lost my train of thought. Did I answer your question, or mostly so? Well, it, okay. Snow turns to ice either by summer melting and then refreezing, or else pressure from, you know, accumulating 100 feet will squeeze the air out 100 feet below it. And as you squeeze the air out, it the molecules get together and it's ice with bubbles in it. So it forms ice pretty readily. But,
okay, well, with that, let's give Michael a hand and thank you for his presentation.